We are now back with Charles Eisenstein. We switched Charles Eisenstein to this place in our program today.
Yes, we unexpectedly have not heard from him. He was supposed to be with us at 9 this morning, and we were hoping that he could then come in here, and we haven't heard from him, which is a shame, and I hope everything's all right with him. And so we have a happen to have an audio of an interview that I did with him a couple of months ago that is very much on point. And so we're lucky enough to have Charles, who is an author and speaker.
For those of you who don't know Charles Eisner is a speaker and writer focusing on the themes of human culture and identity. He's an author of several books. Most recently, he published a book about the circular economy. And the latest book is called The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. His background includes a degree in mathematics and philosophy from Yale. Then he lived in Taiwan for a decade as a translator. And his stints as a college instructor, yoga teacher, and a construction worker. And currently, he writes and is speaking full-time. He lives in Pennsylvania with his wife and his four children.
I think he may have just moved to Asheville, North Carolina. I'm not sure, but anyway, he and I had a conversation about what does a new kind of activism look like. So we'll now hear the recorded interview.
One that we've inherited, at least, casts us as aliens in a world of other.
Yeah.
And then the system also teaches us that. So that's the you know the reality, the discourse, the narrative that's breaking down. Every aspect of it is breaking down. On the structural and institutional level, it's breaking down. And on the ideological level, it's breaking down as well. Even within science, the old Newtonian paradigm of separation, reductionism, dualism, mechanism, objectivity.
Right.
Yeah, it's scientifically obsolete, but that has not infiltrated our consciousness yet on a very deep level.
Yeah,
I think
right.
It only infiltrates when we're ripped open, and that's what the converging crises are doing to us.
So how do you see? Could you speak a bit more about being an activist in this different way? Very good.
So if we accept that the foundation of our world-destroying machine is our perceptions, our consciousness, our sense of self, the story that we live in, then anything that disrupts that story or invites people into a new story is actually a political act. So for me, that kind of broadens the scope of activism. Normally, we only think of an activist as somebody who is engaged on a political level, which usually means trying to stop something.
Right.
Because, I mean, it seems quite clear, you look at what's happening, and there's a lot of stuff that's got to be stopped. So among kind of hardcore activists, if you're not trying to stop something, then you're a little suspect. If, instead of trying to stop the TTIP, the trade treaty. If instead of doing that, you're building an eco-village, then, eco-village is nice, but, there's not going to be any more eco-villages if we don't stop TTIP.
Right.
They're going to be illegal, or even on a smaller scale, what if you're, volunteering at a homeless shelter and you spend hours holding some old homeless man's hand, and that's the only love he's received for 20 years, and he dies the next year of cancer, a healed man, and you spent every evening for a year doing that.
Mm.
Is that a political act?
Mm.
I think it is.
Mm.
And I think that, but you know, again, maybe the hardcore activist would say, well, yeah, that stuff's very nice, it's very important, you know, we have to be balanced and stuff, but that's not activism.
Mm.
And maybe we have to sacrifice some of those more human, slow-paced things in this time of great urgency and crisis. And I think that you know, it's important to embrace, not as a substitute for other kinds of activism, but as something equally important that is actually practice for truly effective activism on the political level. Because
mm-hmm.
what's effective, what will be effective, is activism that comes from love, not from the attempt to overcome the enemy by force.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's impossible. The enemy, if we set things up as an enemy that needs to be overcome by force, we lose.
Mm-hmm.
They have more force.
Mm-hmm.
They have the military industrial complex and the surveillance state and the financial industry. If they will only change by force, it's hopeless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that perception that they'll only change by force, that comes from a wound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's pain in that.
Mm-hmm.
The pain of betrayal, of dashed hopes,
mm-hmm.
of dismay and disappointment in human nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, human beings are like this. This is the way human beings are. You know, you hear things. I mean, you hear that all the time.
Right.
This
yeah,
is
especially. There's such pain and grief inside them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so is it the truth, or is that the projection of our unprocessed grief? Because
mm-hmm.
then, you know, so I think that another part of, like, another foundation for effective activism would be to do some grief work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to really, like, process that grief. And when people come through a deep experience of grief that's held in community, they come out of it a lot more joyful, positive, and optimistic.
Right.
And effective.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I think I think I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm going to bring something in here that may be a kind of detour, but let's see. And my colleagues may shoot me in the head for this, but it'll be only out of love. I was reading something that a student of Adi Da has written, and about acausal activism.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't very clearly articulated, but part of what he was saying, we don't know if you look at the historical context of India and what happened in Gandhi and the Indians kind of overcoming the rule by the British. There were earlier times that were very violent conflicts, but there was something that happened. And when I think about that myself, when I think about, well, what made this change, there was something in the hearts of human beings that saw a different possibility and said, this is real. And that's what he's calling acausal activism, I think. It's like that there's something, you realize that the system that we're in right now wants us to, you know, the system itself has a desire for cynicism, or that cynicism is the handmaiden of it, maybe, to put it that way, and that we're in a context right now that where one's hope, where one's joy, just the one's connection with the sacredness, the beauty, as you were saying, this quality of life that is inherent in life itself, that would be that often we're very far from that because we experience such cynicism about the possibility of that, the thing that you so beautifully entitled your book, that world that the heart desires, is seems so far away. And And that, you know, it's like they're only going to respond through force. We don't have that, you know, like, oh, what would the, all those things serve to keep us in a space that makes the very thing, which is this being in touch with this that the heart wants so much and can see, it makes it hard for us to stay in touch with that. But that is, seems to me to be a big part of the response that's needed. Do you know what I'm saying? Is that clear? That
was kind of, I'm not sure what Adidas means by acausal activism, but some of what you're saying suggests maybe one thing it could mean is action in a situation where we don't know how to get from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have that, like you were talking about the people of India, you know, this stirring in the heart, this knowledge, mm-hmm. that there is a there, that there is another possibility, mm-hmm. that there is some way to get there. Mm-hmm. But we cannot plot out a chain of cause and effect that will bring us there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we try, then the cynic comes along at any point in the chain, mm-hmm. and says, well, that's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are the police are going to, you know, put you in jail, you know, the finance minister would never agree to that, you know, that'll never work, that'll never work. And there's a very good reason at each stage why it's not going to work. And the cynical person says, yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't try.
Feels despair.
Hence despair. Mm-hmm. Because that cynic's, critique is correct on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
But the naive person says, well, I'm going to try anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And goes out into the street, you know, or initiates some kind of seemingly quixotic endeavor. But once that has, so, but once they're out on the street, then things take on a life of its own, take on a life of their own. And things that you could not possibly have predicted begin to happen. So, you end up arriving at that place that you had envisioned along a path that you didn't even know existed.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be one thing that acausal activism would mean. It's like, you know, I'm not doing this because, the reason I'm doing this isn't that I can plot out a sequence of cause and effect that's going to get me there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe sometimes you do have a sequence of cause and effect that'll get you there, and if so, then fine, do that. You know, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
If you have more force than your opponent, force works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the premise of a lot of action films.
Mm-hmm.
The hero prevails because he's more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But what we want to achieve, in general, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have more force. Therefore, we have to walk the invisible path.
Mm-hmm.
Where each action along that path is in a way, you know, irrational.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like a fantasy. It doesn't feel like purposeless martyrdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just going to go out there and get arrested, and I'm going to go to jail, and it's not going to work, but I'm going to do it anyway because you have to try.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like that. There's like this element of fun and creativity to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this audacity.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though you can't explain why it's going to work, you kind of know that. I was going to say you know that it's going to work, but it's not even that, because the result, there might be a result even better than the one that you envisioned.
Well, it's interesting because part of what the action itself and the spirit or heart or that it's coming from is also the goal, you know what I mean? There's a way in which the action that one is taking, because it isn't against something. It's for this that is this deeper, you know, part of ourselves, that is the deeper part of life, that is the wealth in that we have, and
yeah.
And so taking action from that it is bringing into manifestation or bringing out into the world that which is what the change that we want to happen anyway.
Yeah,
in a certain sense.
Right, it kind of creates a field.
Mm.
A field of whatever the intention was.
Mm.
Even if that particular action doesn't succeed.
Yeah.
I know this environmentalist out in California who spent years trying to save a river from being dammed. This was several decades ago. And he and this core group of activists, they tried everything they could. Legal challenges, you know, direct action, protests, you know, petitions, I mean, lobbying. I mean, they did everything they could to stop this river from being destroyed, basically, and they failed. And it was the saddest day of his life. You know, they dammed up the river, and this beautiful ecosystem was just submerged, you know, and it was such a, and it had been like, it was such a painful defeat that he and the other activists thereafter could not even bear to meet each other again.
Oh, wow.
Because the memory was so painful.
Mm.
You know, he devoted so many years, and it failed.
Mm.
But that was the last dam built in North America.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And it was as if their campaign was a prayer.
Mm.
And all of the setbacks were God asking, are you serious?
Mm.
Do you really, really want this to stop?
Mm.
And so we don't know. I think that our conventional understanding of causality is part of the same mythology that is at the root of our system.
Yeah.
It's essentially a force-based causality.
Mm.
But I think that real causality is much, much bigger and more subtle than that.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
We have no idea the links that connect phenomena in our world.
Mm-hmm.
We have like the barest clue of those.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, again, to refer to the movie Aluna, the Kogi shamans, they spend hours watching bubbles in a lake.
Mm.
And from the way that those bubbles are coming up, they know things about the entire region.
Mm.
Like, they consider that there is a causal link between those bubbles and, you know, mangrove swamps 500 miles away that are under threat.
Mm.
Or perhaps even more so, perhaps even traumatic events in the human world will show up in those bubbles. Who knows? But this is, that's their world. And part of the way that we maintain the dominant worldview is to categorize beliefs like that as superstition or magical religious thinking, and essentially to impose a kind of ontological imperialism on those people that perfectly mirrors economic imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
Economic imperialism says, we know how to live better than you do.
Mm-hmm.
Our ways are better than yours, and development means that you take on our ways. Ontological imperialism says that we know the nature of reality better than you.
Mm-hmm.
Your ways of knowing, your beliefs, those are backward.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you might call it epistemological imperialism too.
Right.
You know,
right.
Your very perceptions of the world are less developed than ours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't it time that we let go of that hubris?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, whose society is more sustainable? Whose society is more beautiful? 50 years ago, like, we had a lot of confidence that we were creating a perfect world. But that confidence has been dashed on the you know, rock of the environmental crisis, the ecological crisis, and all the other crises, too. Like, we can no longer say, we know that our way of living, knowing, and being is the best, because what a glorious civilization we've created.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look how well it works.
Mm-hmm.
We can't say that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can still delude ourselves into thinking that with, you know, a strenuous mental calisthenics.
Yeah, and probably so, Prozac too.
Yeah, maybe a little Prozac. we can, but it's really hard. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody really believes in the story of progress anymore, the story of the ascent of humanity.
Well, I wonder about, because I read your story about the Nestle VP.
Yeah.
And I think that there are people who are whose own, whose own worldview is still intact within that.
Yeah.
And I think when you're saying that, I think you're speaking about probably, it's to some extent, generational, a kind of generational awareness, I think, and a probably politically progressive,
yeah,
or spiritually, you know, sensitive.
I don't know though, like,
yeah,
the Nestle exec, like in her private moments, you know, if you got her outside of her, outside of the conditions that that enforce the role that she plays,
mm-hmm,
and the person that she's being, you know, you get her in, you know, a retreat center,
mm-hmm,
and you say, do you have any doubt? You know, is there something that doesn't feel quite right?
Mm.
You know, do you ever question everything?
Mm.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, maybe she wouldn't, but I think that maybe most people feel the presence of some kind of void,
mm,
underneath their story of the world and their story of self.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Like a discontent.
Yeah.
You know, this, like,
yeah,
feeling like it's not supposed to be this way.
Mm. But it's interesting because I see in the shift with women that there's an agitation, you know, that there's you know, a sense of things aren't right. And at a certain level, though, this not rightness, which I think is a much bigger not rightness, is interpreted like my husband's, you know, really bugging me.
Right.
Or
it gets projected onto something.
Exactly. Gets, yeah, projected onto something within that is still within the story, the old story, or the old way of thinking about who I am. It's like, I should be married, I should have a great house, I should have great kids. And then so it's sort of, you go, you know, the husband stinks, the house is too small, and, you know, and the kids are bad right now.
And yep, and that diverts the revolutionary energy.
Exactly.
Away from anything that will cause real change. And the same thing happens politically. You know, the,
yeah,
problem is the corporate execs, the problem is the Koch brothers, the problem is Sheldon Adelson, you know, the problem is, you know, Chancellor Merkel, you know.
Yeah.
And if we only could, you know, get rid of the husband, you know, move to a bigger house, you,
mm,
know, and elect someone else, like,
yeah,
then things would be better.
And right.
So the energy for change gets diverted into something that actually is, like you said, inside the same story.
Mm.
And I think that one way that the big change happens is, and it doesn't always happen this way, but she gets a bigger house and a new husband and so and so forth, and she's still not happy.
Yeah.
And that precipitates a crisis.
Right.
Like, I've got everything I wanted, and I'm still not happy. So here, I think, like, a major landmark in our process of transition was the election amidst great hopes of President Obama.
That's right.
And then the severe disappointment,
right,
that came, like, that people just, you know, that came when he didn't make any significant changes.
Right.
And on the one hand, that fosters cynicism, but it also, like, you know, it's a major step in people, like, not investing hope in these relatively superficial things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that in Europe too. Like,
mm-hmm,
you know, they, whenever a left wing government is elected, they do the same thing as the neoliberal government.
Mm-hmm.
And they, even Syriza,
mm-hmm,
you know, is very limited in what it can do given the roles that that exist for it to occupy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I still have a lot of admiration for mm-hmm. what they have done, but mm-hmm. You know, the same. So it's a part of the process. You know, you get what you thought you wanted, what you thought was the solution, and maybe that's the only way to realize that it wasn't.
Right.
And then so then the questioning gets a lot deeper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are the some stories or examples of things that inspire you and give you a great deal of hope at this point?
Anytime that the normal response of revenge and hatred and punishment gives way to a response of healing and love.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I can think of a lot of recent examples.
You can name something from your book, or
I'm just right now what popped into my head, which isn't in any of my books, but there was a school shooting here.
Mm-hmm.
It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. A gunman went into an Amish school
mm-hmm.
and killed a bunch of schoolgirls.
Mm-hmm.
And when the media came and asked the parents what they wanted, you know, what punishment they wanted, what they wanted to see happen to the killer, they said that they wanted, that they forgave him.
Mm.
And that there's been enough violence.
Mm.
That, things like that give me hope. You know, the peace and reconciliation committees,
mm-hmm.
flawed though they may have been, those give me hope, you know.
Mm.
Right now, the things that really give me hope are happening mostly kind of under the surface. The success of Podemos in Spain and Syriza and those things, like, those are more, you know, like, really my optimism just comes from understanding how big change happens in life.
Mm-hmm.
It happens through a process of crisis, and breakdown, uncertainty, and then the emergence of something new.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I can hold the inevitability and horror mm-hmm. of the crisis
mm-hmm.
in my mind out of despair.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is just how things happen. This mm-hmm. is how change happens. And that doesn't mean to sit by complacently and watch it happen. Because the way that this dynamic works is that the crisis calls forth in us the activism and the capacities that were dormant. So the response of passivity is perhaps based on a misunderstanding of the dynamic
mm-hmm.
of transition. Mm-hmm. If you can try to sit back and be passive, but what will happen is that the crisis will visit you personally
mm-hmm.
in some way that calls you forth to action.
Mm-hmm.
We are essentially in a birth process, mm-hmm. and we're the baby.
Mm-hmm.
We, like, things are happening to us, and mostly what we do is respond to them
mm-hmm.
as best we can. The mother is doing 99% of the work,
mm-hmm.
but the baby does do 1% of the work.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to give birth to a live baby than a stillborn,
because
mm-hmm. so, the baby's life responses are mm-hmm. part of the birth process.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are to be not a silver, but if we're going to be a live baby, if we're going to be born into the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible,
mm-hmm.
That will require our life responses,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the, which include all the action that we're taking in the face of the horror and the wrongness. It even includes the phase of despair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's part of it too. Because that's what comes right before surrender, where we let go of what we thought we knew and are open to something different and larger.
Mm. It's interesting because that moment of surrender is also what calls forward answers or knowledge, information, solutions, things, creativity that actually did not exist in us. It didn't exist in our way of understanding before.
That's right, yeah.
It's that opening to something completely unknown, but then that unknown takes you to the next step that you couldn't have seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I was talking about with acausal activism.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm intrigued by this term. I'm like, whoa, is this, there's something, yeah, this is very interesting. And I thought you were talking about things that were very parallel or very related to it.
All right, welcome back from this interview that was obviously pre-recorded and in the context of our magazine Evolve several weeks ago. But it really, I think it fits surprisingly well to what we try also to have as part of the conversation for this broadcast for One World Rising. And one thing that you really touched is the topic of acausal activism, mm-hmm. and acausal change.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I was going to say, I think I was very much thinking about these themes when I spoke to Charles. And this acausal activism is something that I think is really, really at the core of a new kind of activism. And the acausality comes from going beyond one's own kind of will, in a sense, to a deeper human encounter. An encounter with, I think, often that comes out of desperation or out of a sense of that transcends, I think, our limitations.
And it also comes from a relationship to something that is beyond our usual individuality and our usual individual understanding of ourselves. It is related to a layer of trust. That allows things to happen, not from a causal, from an instrumental understanding how things happen, but because there is something underlying positive, mm-hmm. That one can rely to, without having kind of a analytical understanding what this is.
Yeah, it's interesting because what it is kind of let go so deeply of all of those kinds of things and reach for something because you care that much. Anyway, we have...
In fact, I want to speak about this very thing also with our next guest, but we start again with music. So I welcome Sandra Delorant to our conversation. Sandra, are you with us on the phone?
Yes, I'm right here. Thank you for the invitation to participate.
Oh, great to hear you,
great
Sandra.
Great to hear, Sandra. If I may say some words about you, just as a short introduction, Sandra is an indigenous women's leader and a ceremonialist affiliated with the altar of the Chief Eagle Claw of the Great Dakota Nation. And you say that you follow only one principle, and this is to live your prayer. and I really would like to speak with you more about that. You say, if your prayer is for the good health and the happiness of the people and the healing of Mother Earth, then one's daily action must move in that direction. So this is definitely something I would like to talk with you about. But the first question, we heard some music, and you chose this music, and I really would like, why did you choose this particular music?
This song was given to me in ceremony, and it's being rendered by my daughter, Sarah. Mm. And it's in the Cree language, and the opening words talk about our grandfather and how our grandfathers gave us the home and gave us the fire, and we hold on to that. And then the second verse talks about the gifts that the grandmothers have given us, the gifts of truth and the gifts of life, and we hold on to those things. So it really, to me, speaks to my heart as those things that we hold that help us to walk our daily path.
Mm. And you, as Thomas was just reading, our daily path is to live our prayer. Can you say more about that?
Mm. Well, I think all of us that have been brought up in today's society often disconnect or compartmentalize our spiritual practice or principles to how we live our daily lives. So, you know, if we go to church on Sunday and then not understand or feel that prayer throughout the week, then that holy hour, you know, was not spent well.
Right.
So then, yeah, so when we practice our living, it is about what we pray for, what we ask for is really what we need to move forward with in our lives. So if we're asking for good health and happiness, you know, then you put yourself in a place where you are putting the right things into your body and being with people and being with yourself in a good place. And not all of us are able to do that. So I know for myself, I had a lot of time for most of my life compartmentalized my work, my education, my spirit, you know, and it really does get to be disconnecting.
Mm.
And so one day it was like, you know, we were told that what we pray for, what we ask for, is how we live our lives. Because we can't expect, well, Spirit gives us the tools, but we have to use those tools.
Mm. Right, right. It's interesting, actually, when you think about it, that how revealing our prayers are of what world we're living in, aren't they? I mean, it's interesting, Sandra. I was thinking, when we spoke in our pre-interview, you mentioned how your foremothers fought or not fought with, in terms of violence, but how they protected the sacred ceremonies, the sacred teachings of your people from from the colonization of the, you know, the white Europeans that were committing genocide against your people, basically. Can you talk about how your the knowledge has been preserved and the role that women have played in this?
Well, I believe, and we know, because we're still here, that our women are people who are very resilient. And I know one of the Western concepts is flight or fight. Mm-hmm. And then in other indigenous traditions, it's like flight or dance, right? So mm-hmm. our women and ceremonialists chose to dance. Mm-hmm. So rather than give up or give in, they found a way to continue to connect with the spirit and with the land. And I know that in my own family, in my own story, that we have, like our grandmothers have done it. They had, you know, taken the children, taken their families deep into the forest to hold ceremony, to pick the roots that they used as medicine to keep the communities healthy. And so in some ways that still exists today. You know, people really are very take conscious effort to preserve and protect the ceremony and the medicine, because you just never know when it's going to change. You know, it's an open environment now. People are interested in learning and living that practice. But our history has taught us that sometimes it can disappear. Mm. So we just have to, as in the case of our ancestors, who, you know, literally had to continue the practice at the threat of their lives, because there is legislation in this country, for sure, that prohibited ceremonial activity, and the penalty, you know, was incarceration up to and including loss of life. So they did that work in spite of what they knew to be the penalty. So for me, that, you know, is in some ways an act of defiance, mm-hmm. but it's also an act of strength and resilience, which they gave us.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's inspiring to hear about this strength and resilience that you're talking about, that they gave you, and how it was not an easy history that you experienced basically the last 300 years of European colonization. And it is a very specific situation in North America, I would say. You're in Canada, but it's similar also in the United States, because in the United States and in Canada is maybe that place on that globe where a hyper-modernist culture and an indigenous culture are living closest together. And this togetherness was not always a very peaceful togetherness. In fact, as Elizabeth said, it was a genocidal togetherness at some point. But still, there is this hyper-modernist North American Canadian culture that you are living in, that is on the forefront of what modernism brought to the globe. And there is the tradition that you are talking about that came from your ancestors, from the mothers. Do you feel in this close encounter of the tradition of your people and the tradition of European culture brought by the Canadians to Canada, that there is a specific a meeting point that is important both for your people and for the Europeans living in Canada?
Okay, I might go off on a tangent, but
yes, please.
I think here's you know, we talk about the genocidal policy and the impact of the lack of understanding between cultures and the settler culture and the indigenous culture. I think where there's an opportunity to connect is, again, you know, going back to the most basic understanding, and that is to see ourselves as human beings. And I remember, you know, going to a conference several years ago, and I was like learning how to walk on my path, and the people that introduced themselves first, you know, talked about their clan and their lineage and their name, and I thought, oh, I don't know any of that. Mm. So I was getting really nervous and anxious. By the time it came to me, I thought, well, I introduced myself by my name, and I then said, and I'm just another human being. Mm. And really, you know, we have all kinds of things that identify us as people, but at our core, we are just human beings, and how we learn to live with and coexist with one another is really critical. And we talk about, or we look at the most recent events with the refugee situation. We talk mm-hmm. about globalization.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And seeing the young boy on the on the banks of the, or on the shore, mm-hmm. you know. People around the globe didn't see him as a refugee. Mm-hmm. They saw him right. as a little boy. Mm-hmm. You know, they recognized that humanity. Mm-hmm. And he shifted that, woke people up to shift to think in terms of human beings, person to person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how here in this country or in North America or in our relationship with Indigenous people, it's around the globe, is seeing our humanity and seeing our similarities and not our differences. The great leveler in all of that is, of course, the technology. You know, I think that people, Indigenous people in particular, and there is research that bears it out, are the highest users or have been able to integrate technology and social media into their living. Mm. Because it, in many ways, it is a reflection of the tradition uh-huh. or the spirit, you know, in a different context. Mm. And I can say that in terms of one of the elders who, when the computer first came to their community about 15 years ago, he had asked in Cree, what does this do? Mm. And so it was explained to him, and his response, again in Cree, so one of the ceremonies that we have is called a shake tent. So he explained to Cree, oh, so it's like a shake tent. So this shake tent brings the voice of the spirit into this world, which people are then, you know, given direction to act on, right? Mm-hmm. And so then in a technological sense, yes, that is what a computer does. So those frameworks and integrations can be
Sandra, you're still on? Or
I'm here.
You're not sure if we lost the stream. If I may pick up on that, because I found it very very sure. very intriguing, because on one hand it shows exactly what you're talking about, our shared humanity. But the story you were telling also shows something different. The particular way this elder from the Lakota Nation responded from the Cree Nation responded to a computer is a very particular way that maybe only Indigenous people really can respond in this way. This relationship to spirit in relationship to technology is something that I find very intriguing, but it wouldn't necessarily come natural to me as you are speaking about it. And I wonder if there's something from your relationship to spirit in your tradition and daily life that our modernist culture really can learn from. And I, every time I come to the United States, I haven't been to Canada yet, I'm quite intrigued that in spite of the brutal history between the white people and the indigenous people in the US, there is a strong connection also, because the indigenous culture is so close in history, part of the American culture. That's very different to Europe, where our indigenous past is basically 2,000 years ago, and we developed slowly the European culture. But there's a direct connection, and there's also...
But I think, can I say something there? Because I think what's interesting is that it's not a European indigenous culture.
No, it's not a European indigenous culture, but it is an indigenous culture. And there's a, what I was trying to aim at is there seems to be a longing from the European side to connect. And if I'm right, this longing to connect is something that is getting stronger in this time. And I think there's something to be learned in this close encounter between these different forms of human culture, to really find out about our shared humanity. And I just wonder if you share this sentiment with me. So I just hear that we maybe lost the stream with Sandra.
Oh, she's back.
And now she's back.
Okay, so
Sandra,
sorry about that. Technology can be, the spirits of technology can be a little make jokes, I think, this way. Are you with us?
Alessandra? Hello?
Hello.
Oh,
hello.
Good. You're back?
You're back.
I'm back.
We can hear you. Yeah. Did you hear my question? I don't know how much you heard of what I said before.
I didn't hear the last part of it.
To cut it short, I think that because of the close encounter between modernist culture and indigenous culture in the North American context, there seems to be a very particular learning set where, let's say, there's a lot that can be relearned because it was lost in the European tradition from the wisdom of the elders and from the mothers. Is it something that you experience, that there's a new sentiment of learning in the North American culture?
From the white people.
From the white people?
Well, here's the thing. I think the primary difference is in settler culture, primarily Christian culture, no one has ever seen God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in our tradition or teaching, we are taught to see the great mystery in every day and in every person. So when you hear the wind blowing, you see the spirit, you hear the spirit of the wind. When you see the grass waving in the wind, it's the, you acknowledge that as creation caressing Mother Earth. When you hear, sit by the water and hear the water running, you acknowledge that as the song of creation. So I think that's the difference in how we're taught to live in our environment and see God or see Creator in every living thing, because every little living thing is animate and has a spirit.
Mm. And do you, I guess I'm wondering if if what is there something that you would want the settler culture to learn from your ways, or that you would say this would be wonderful if they could see this, if we could see this?
Well, you know, it would be wonderful if they could see, feel, and experience that and learn from that culture, because then I think it really changes the dynamic for relationship at a personal level, at a systems level, and a political level.
Right.
You know, because right now, the systems and government very much see us as a burden.
Uh-huh.
And when we look at protecting and preserving the land, like the women who had started the Idle No More movement, that was about protecting the land and the water. And, you know, they were completely ostracized, and people that were involved in the Idle No More movement were seen as terrorists, and as a result, we have an anti-terrorism legislation.
Wow.
So that then there can be continued exploitation of the resources of the land, and ultimately exploitation of the spirit. I mean, this is our only home, and we have to take care of it.
Mm. That's right. Thank you, Sandra. I think we've unfortunately come to the end of our time. And it's been, I think what you just said there was very powerful.
Right.
Very, very powerful. And I deeply appreciate hearing from you and hearing your call, actually. And your, maybe you could say, hearing your prayer for what needs to happen. I appreciate that.
And I do hope that this conversation will serve that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much for being with us and making time for this dialogue.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation and the time, and I'm listening to the rest of the speakers, and it is very powerful.
Mm, great.
So thank you for your vision.
Yeah, thank you very much. And
bye-bye.
Next speaker, and I like the word co-conspirator. We're breathing together on this vision of a global dialogue. Our next co-conspirator is Walter Pflueger. Dr. Pflueger is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology. Now, he's the editor of the Howard Thurman Papers Project. Now, I'm sure everyone who is listening knows who Martin Luther King is, Martin Luther King Jr. is. But who you probably don't know is Howard Thurman. And Howard Thurman is a mystic, an African-American mystic, a minister, a theologian, who was dean of, dean at the BU School of Theology, and was Martin Luther King Jr.'s mentor. Now, Walter Pflueger has been studying and preserving the legacy of Howard Thurman for for decades, and he himself, what I found very powerful in speaking with him when Thomas and I spoke with him earlier, he is an extraordinary expression himself and transmitter of the grounded mysticism of Howard Thurman. And I as for me, as a white American, United States, you can't quite just say America. Canada is not, I'm not from Canada, but I'm from the United States. As a white woman from the United States, I found that Dr. Pfluger brought a perspective that is a human wake-up call. And I'm very, very privileged and honored to be able to welcome Walter Pfluger to our global gathering. Welcome, Walter.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I'm so happy to be with you.
Thank you, Walter. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you again. And I've been assisted by all of your folks in getting in the right space.
That's good. That's good. Oh, appreciate that. I know this technology can be a bit of an irritant, but it also brings us together. And yesterday we had, I haven't checked today, but yesterday we had over 700 people globally together listening. Today I would imagine, because we're on a time that is easier for America to listen into, that we probably have more. But anyway, I would love for you to speak about I think the spiritual strength of Howard Thurman, of the spiritual strength that you find in the work that you do, and what can it bring to the dominant culture that the dominant culture doesn't see right now?
Thanks again for inviting me and for asking me to be a part of this. You mentioned that most people in the world, in fact, know about Martin Luther King Jr., but very few are aware of the incredible tradition that produced individuals like Martin Luther King Jr. We formally call it the Black Church tradition, but in many ways it's a larger conversation like what we're having. It's a discourse exists even today, but certainly began when the first Africans were brought to this country and had to adapt to a hostile and alien environment, which brought about different kinds of ways of interpreting religious experience. I only say that because in order to really get a good sense of King and Howard Thurman, one has to have some sense of the vibrancy of this tradition and the ways in which it shapes certain kinds of characters and certain kinds of leaders. Early in my research as a doctoral student, I completed a dissertation on the concept of community in the thought of Howard Thurman and Martin Luther King Jr. And it was clear to me that most people, of course, knew about King, but only a very select group of folks at that time had a good sense of who Howard Thurman was. He was an African-American born in Daytona, Florida in 1899, at the turn of the 20th century, lived a long life until 1981.
Wow.
And during the span of that life, served as, of course, a pastor, a theologian at several academic institutions, dean of the chapel, Marsh Chapel, here at Boston University, which was an appointment for Thurman, which was, he was the first African-American dean to be appointed to a major white university, which was in many ways groundbreaking. That was early in 1953.
Wow.
One of the reasons I placed them in a common tradition is because King shared many mentors. Thurman was one of the significant mentors by virtue of being also a Morehouse man. King was a graduate of Morehouse College in Atlanta, where I taught for 14 years. And Thurman was an earlier graduate. And to understand Thurman and King, one also has to understand the Morehouse tradition. So in many ways, they were shaped by common traditions, common practices. One of the interesting things is the different ways in which they enter the conversation on spirituality and social transformation. Thurman, the older visionary, was really set early on in his life on finding a way to deepen the spirit. Sometimes his language is religious experience. Seldom did he call himself a mystic, but he was a mystic in every sense of the word. A nature mystic, to be exact. He spent many of his early years in Florida, he says, talking to an old oak tree in his backyard and communing with the Halifax River and the Atlantic Ocean. And it, he was shaped in many ways by these experiences with nature and with his grandmother, who was really a spiritual genius of sorts. One would suspect that she still embodied many of the habits and practices of her own African ancestry. And I think Thurman inherited much of this from his grandmother. But Thurman's point of entry, to be precise, was into the nature of religious experience, or what I like to call the interiority of experience. And most of his education after Morehouse College in 1923 was basically pursuing what he called the scent of life. He had a belief that life itself is alive. He said the most obvious characteristic of life is that life itself is alive, and that we often miss this because we are so deeply in life that we seldom spend time noticing life. And he builds an entire religious perspective from this understanding of life. And in some ways, it has affinity with Henri Bergson, the vitalism of life, the idea of the difference between instinct and intelligence. You would probably have some sense of that. Thurman's is very distinctive, however, because of the ways in which I think he's shaped by the experience, not only with nature, but the deep experience of oppression. For African Americans, especially in the South. The lacerating experiences of growing up being African American in Florida and later in Georgia, being in a society which still was lynching, especially black men in those parts of the world, and at the same time being an incredible spirit, intellectual spirit, deeply religious moorings of a person like Thurman, I think were part of the kind of early ways in which he moved into this thing of noticing life. And basically he says if you notice life, it has a kind of a teleological character, the same way that a plant turns to the sun without any prompting. We would probably have some fuss about that in the academy nowadays, but for Thurman, it was very important to notice the way life has a kind of almost autonomous nature in itself. And because it is alive, he felt that life would always have dominion over the contradictions in life. And the main one, of course, being death. He did not believe that death and even suffering were final. though they were essential and necessary ingredients in the flow of life, he felt that ultimately life would have dominion. So many people read Thurman, his meditations for spiritual nourishing, but very few have a deep sense of the kind of deep intellectual mooring of his work. And most of my work over the past 20 plus, maybe 30 years now, has been looking into his papers and the materials he left us. I'm the editor of a project called the Howard Thurman Papers Project, and there are over 58,000 documents in our database.
Wow.
To give you some sense of who this man was.
Mm.
He corresponded with people as lowly as his school teachers, even to the end of his life,
mm-hmm.
and as lofty as Mahatma Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer, and on.
Wow.
A great soul.
Wow.
I think I mentioned to you in the last conversation that Thurman led the first African-American delegation to meet with Mahatma Gandhi
yeah.
in 1936. And it was at this meeting with Gandhi, it was only a two-hour meeting, it was Gandhi who said to Thurman and his small delegation that he believed that the unadulterated message of Satyagraha would come to the world through the African American.
Mm.
And
may I,
if I may just come
in here and ask you about also the specific understanding or his specific form of mysticism that you were describing, that life itself is alive. And do you think that this is directly related also to the tradition of the Black Church in America and to the African-American spirituality that you were just mentioning? Do you think there's a tradition in the Black Church that has a particular relationship to this understanding that life itself is alive?
I certainly do, and I don't rush to attribute everything in Thurman's or King's experience, for that matter, specifically to African experiences, because Africa, before it was Africa, was a lot of countries.
Yeah.
Right.
And with the Modernist Project, we get Africa. But, you know, right. But Thurman, we've been able, I think, to trace some of his heritage, his genealogy. We think that Thurman is probably from the coastal area of the Gambia.
Uh-huh.
And it was from this area in West Africa that many of the African slaves who came settled in South Carolina
mm-hmm.
near the Sea Islands on into Georgia and, of course, Thurman into Florida. I make this point because this is also an area still in the United States where there are significant African retentions in religious practices.
Uh-huh.
Not the least of being conversations with natural objects.
Uh-huh.
Not some kind of crass animism, but to really be in experiences with nature and learning to discern the language and the signs that nature itself expresses. Thurman is certainly part of that tradition. And in some ways, to answer your question more fully, Thurman might be best understood, I argue, at some point, more than just an intellectual or theologian or great preacher. He was also shamanistic. Almost, he would never acknowledge this, but so many of us who shared his presence were aware that there was a kind of clairvoyance about Thurman. He could look deeply into the experience of the other, and even in his own language, he could come out on the other side.
Mm. Uh-huh.
Mm.
And this is an experienced thing that he had in 1958 when King was stabbed while signing a book in Harlem in New York, Stride Toward Freedom. Thurman wrote in his autobiography that one morning a strange visitation came to him in the form of Martin's face. He did not know what had happened at that point, but he told his wife that he needed to find Martin wherever he was. And through several interviews, I've kind of traced the journey that he made to Martin Luther King Jr. in 1958 at the Harlem Hospital. And it was there, and I've written about this, that he offered some very profound advice to King. He says to him that the movement of which you are part, this is 1958, King has 10 more years to live. He says, unless you deepen your channels, the very movement of which you will of which you are a part will swallow you up. But if you commit yourself to, during these weeks of convalescence, he recommended that King extend his convalescence beyond the weeks that the doctors had recommended, and spend time in meditation and prayer. King says in his own writings, and all of his critical biographies suggest, that he spent more time during this period in meditation and prayer than he had in his entire adult life. And it's no accident to me, I'm making a huge assumption, but I think it's true, that it was shortly thereafter that King is on his way to India in the early 1960s, February of 1959, to India. And it was there that King says in the land of Gandhi, he made his own decision to become a full devotee of nonviolent resistance. Before then, King, as many of us know, actually owned a gun. And the return from India was a significant part of his development. I link it, of course, to Thurman and some other things that were going on in the movement at that time. I hope that's helpful. I don't want to overstate the case, but Thurman had this gift, and there are so many people who are fully aware of it. My own experience when I studied with Thurman in the late 70s, one day all I could do was write poetry in his presence. It was the strangest thing. I laugh now because it was so strange at that point. But I later discovered that others were having similar experiences.
Wow, that's remarkable. That's really remarkable. Wow. It's interesting. How do you, it's, I mean, you started off our conversation now by speaking about the Black Church and the tradition of the Black Church and how, and Thurman growing up in that, but also in a context that in which you said the retention of African spirituality in South Carolina and the area that he was in was very high. His grandmother was a very powerful, you called her a spiritual genius.
Well, she was, I think, a midwife and also a local kind of healer, leader in the community.
Yes, and that, yeah, amazing. And but I'm how, what was Thurman's relationship to Christianity?
Now, I'm glad you asked the question because Thurman had a real struggle with the church. Though he was a Christian minister, he was ordained in the Baptist Church. Thurman's father, Saul Solomon Thurman, Saul Ambrose Solomon Thurman, was actually not a church attender. His mother was, his grandmother was, but the father had some very critical understandings of Christianity. Consequently, when he died from an illness, the church deacons would not bury him in the church. And the pastor refused him. And a traveling evangelist did the eulogy and that he preached Dharma's father's funeral and sent him to hell, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Sam Cromarty. Dharma never forgot this guy's name when he would say it, Sam Cromarty. Because as a little kid, he said he held his grandmother's knee and said, Grandma, he didn't know Daddy, did he? He didn't know Daddy.
Wow.
And so ongoing struggle with the church, with Christianity. And for me, it's no accident that Thurman is one of the early pioneers in this country interracial and interfaith and intercultural, but interfaith dialogue. His church, the Fellowship Church for All Peoples, located in San Francisco, still in existence, was co-founded by Thurman and another minister and philosopher, Alfred Fisk, in 1943. And we've just completed our third volume, which covered this, by the way. And Thurman began a full-blown experiment in diversity of religious belief as well as culture and race. Alan Payton, Cry the Beloved Country, completed his book while a member of that congregation in residence. Eleanor Roosevelt was a member. The French artist, dancer, Josephine Baker, some very distinguished people were part of this cadre. And there were regular services with Jewish and even some Buddhist fellowships. It was part of his dream to create a religious experience, which he felt that in the presence of God, there is neither male nor female, black nor white, nor any other division which separates one human being from another. This was his basic hypothesis.
What do you see? So,
these early experiences were also experiences that challenged him to think long and hard about the meaning of Christianity, especially for African Americans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you see that this? So we're here. We're having a conversation about the deep humanness that that we share as across this globe. The different ways in which our cultures or lands have shaped us, our experiences, our history, and what do you see that this tradition, which is a very special tradition within you could say spirituality, religion in the United States, within the Black Church, within human history, actually, what do you think that it offers us in terms of our encounter with each other across boundaries, across these kinds of boundaries?
There are two or three ways to respond to that. I'll try to respond briefly. But one way is to think about what does it mean to embrace a religion which was not meant to in any way add to your human flourishing. The early Africans who were brought to this country were not allowed early on to have their own religious experiences. They formed what was called the invisible institution. The Black Church early on was called the invisible institution because enslaved people, would meet in brush harbors and have their own religious experience, away from the eyes and the gaze of their masters. Very important point. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these early travelers, humans, took what was meant to be their disgrace and shame, and a religion which was not designed for them, and made of it something that they could call their own. For me, that's just absolutely miraculous.
Mm.
Speaking of doing and conspiring, that made one of the great gifts of African-American creative improvisation. And much in the same ways that we think of jazz and hip-hop, this incredible ability to become bricoleurs, to take the materials that experience gives us and to refashion them. My language is to conjure them in language, in signs, in art, that gives birth to something new and different and vital. One, that's another reason you really can't get to King unless you understand this tradition. Isn't it just magnificent to see how Martin Luther King Jr. arrives on the stage of history,
yeah,
almost with his lines like they've been rehearsed? One doesn't get there without having a long history and a long memory, that has shaped a character, a kind of embodied history that arrives with people like King. So that's, to answer one, that one way, Elizabeth, is to name this kind of improvisational artistry, this conjuring, which I think all human beings are constantly doing and exchanging. But learning how to share that now on a global platform may be one of the ways in which we make some sense of this crazy place that we're at right now. What might that mean? What might be the new language, the new sign, the new creative possibilities that are on the horizon, even in the midst of our suffering and the incredible dysfunctionalities of governments and the terror of many governments? What might that mean to see a new generation of leaders, of spokespersons, of common people who dare to be improvisational actors, creating something new and vital for the world? Technology does allow that.
Yes.
Hip-hop may be one of the vehicles, but I'm sure there are others.
Right.
Yes. That's. Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking your time and being with us. And
bringing this whole tradition also on the global table in our small but global conversation. Because, as you said, everyone does know Martin Luther King Jr., but not the tradition he comes from and where his spirituality is rooted in. And I think it's a contribution that is really, it needs to be known, because it's much bigger than the personal, although he was carrying it as a person, but he was carrying this tradition.
Yes.
We all are bearers of traditions. And it's good to be a bearer, and it's also good to be in constant critique of those traditions, so that we never become stuck in places, especially in times when the creative is called for. And I think that's part of where we are now. We're still struggling with some old dead weight of traditions that are no longer good for us. That incite violence and hatred. And Thurman, I really think, might be a critical resource in helping us to think beyond this impasse.
Yeah,
interesting.
I think that makes a lot of sense. His emphasis on this aliveness is something that is available to every human being, and you can't. I don't think you can use that as a weapon, can you?
No, it's something about this. To be aware of the aliveness, so there's a level of consciousness, and it was sometimes that consciousness precedes being. I'd like to see both of them still in interplay, and ways in which I think that happens is the ways in which we not only contemplate these possibilities, but we become the living embodiment of those possibilities. And that calls for social action. that calls for just and peacemaking in the world. And no one gets there until they step out on stage.
That's right. Actually,
on the world.
That's right. And actually, I think all of us have to realize that we are on a world stage now. We had a speaker yesterday, Walter, say that you come to these things, these realizations, on one's own spiritual journey. And as part of that journey, one realizes, oh, my actions are having an impact. And who I am, how I think, how I be, will have an impact in ways that I can't see. And we're together in this. I think that we have to up our game and to realize there are those who are on a world stage like Martin Luther King Jr., but each of us right now needs to be acting with that kind of awareness.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. We deeply appreciate your being with us.
Thank you so much, Walter.